the letters for Thursday, April 11th, 2024. Arden Zwelling here with Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producer this week is Shoali. Follow him on Twitter at SNSAli. Listen to him after the games on the weekends doing Jays talk with a rotating cast of insightful characters such as Julia Croyes and Nick Ashbourne. And thanks as well to Nick Andrade for editing and producing the video element of ATL this week and every week over on Sportsnet's YouTube. Ben, it has been a very interesting week in baseball and specifically in the AL East for young emergent talent, right? You know, all eyes glued to this exciting middle infield prospect with the loud bat and easy power, a guy who's been just raking at AAA, gaudy exit velocity numbers, as many walks as strikeouts. But you know, that's enough about Addison Barger, because there's also Jackson Holliday, who made his MLB debut this week and has done some of those same things. So very interesting times at the AL East.
Yeah, for sure. That's an unexpected Addison Barger shout out. For him to be the first Blue Jay named on this week's edition of the pod. But hey, I didn't realize that. He's off to a good start at AAA.
Oh, hell yeah, man. Addison Barger hitting .308 through his first 10 games at AAA this year, a .413 on base, a .513 slug, 6 extra base hits, 1-1 strikeout to walk. Look, Jackson Holliday was leading AAA with 20 balls in play at 95 plus miles per hour this year upon his big league call-up. Addison Barger right there with him with 16. So don't sleep on Barger while we're all paying attention to Holliday right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's good for Barger. That's really good. I mean, I think that, I know you're saying that obviously tongue-in-cheek, and I think that, you know, when it comes to Jackson Holliday, I'm honestly so intrigued to see what he can do. I feel like he could hit .315 in the major leagues this year. I'm not saying he will. Obviously, it's a tough league, the toughest league, but I think it's pretty interesting. And you know, for a 20-year-old to come up, and obviously covering the Blue Jays, we're pretty familiar with players with big league pedigree, so to speak, and what advantages that can provide, what challenges that can mean. I tend to think that there are way more advantages than challenges, and I tend to think that being the son of an all-star major leaguer is a really big help in the development of those players and in their progression. And so Holliday not only has that talent, but he's got some of that comfort level that not a lot of players necessarily have at age 20.
The thing about Holliday, like, because it's funny, because you see guys like, even Vlad, right? Like, Vlad's like, what, 25 right now, but he doesn't look like a kid. You know, he's always looked like this big dude, like, obviously a ton of power. That's why he hits the ball as hard as he does. He's got dreadlocks and a beard. And, like, you know, even Alek Manoah, right? Like, when he comes up at 23, he's a monster. He's a giant. Like, he's just a huge man. And it's like, are you really, you know, this young? Are you really a kid? Jackson Holliday actually looks that young. Like, he looks like he looks younger than 20, honestly. Like, just seeing him, like, on a big league field, like, playing with men, like, just visually, he looks out of place. Like, he looks like a high schooler, but obviously, like, the numbers speak for themselves, and obviously he can't handle himself at this level.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. I mean, he really does look young. He is young. I mean, he was drafted out of high school less than 2 years ago. Like, he was, you know, 2 years ago, we're sitting on this podcast talking about Ross Stripling trying to, you know, emerge as a starting pitcher for the Jays. And Jackson Holliday at that point is like getting ready for prom. Like, that's a couple years ago, right? Like, that's not long ago for most of our listeners. Like, 2 years, I mean, yeah, of course things change, but, like, you know, in the scope of like an adult life, 2 years isn't necessarily that long. But for him, it's like, yeah, he was in high school. Now here he is in the major leagues and ready to contribute. He's not here as a feel good story. He is here to contribute, and I fully expect that he will.
Oh, things change in an awful hurry in baseball, because he's here to contribute along with a, like, 22-year-old Gunnar Henderson and like a 25, 26-year-old Adley Rutschman and a 24-year-old Colton Cowser and a 25-year-old Jordan Westberg. I mean, there's just all these young, homegrown, talented players around the diamond for Baltimore. And that's to say nothing of like a Kobe Mayo and a Heston Kjerstad and a Kyle Stowers, a Connor Norby, like all these guys who are raking at Norfolk along with Holliday, who are still on the way and still part of this like amazing developmental pipeline that the Orioles have. Like, this is who the Blue Jays were like 2-3 years ago when they were graduating Guerrero and Bichette and Kirk and Manoa, and the talk was, wow, like the Blue Jays are this young, emergent, upcoming team. They're so well positioned to be a force in the American League East for years to come. Well, here we are, April 2024, and the Orioles are that, and the Blue Jays are this like sneaky old veteran team in the AL East with all these dudes in their early to mid 30s, and in, you know, one case with Justin Turner, his late 30s. Things have changed in an awful hurry for the Blue Jays, who don't have much playoff success to show for all of that potential over the last few years.
They have zero playoff success. Let's call it like it is.
That's accurate.
Yeah, they have not won a single game.
Let me fact check that. And yes, yeah. It is zero wins. Yes, that is correct.
Still looking for that first. Now, you know, just out of curiosity, because I did that 2-year throwback, I looked to where the Blue Jays are or were 2 years ago on this date. And actually, it's funny, their team looks pretty similar. It's Springer, Bichette, Vlad. Kirk's in the lineup. You know, Manoa started that game. He was actually great against the Yankees. 6 shutout innings, 7 Ks. Romano closed it out. Trevor Richards came in relief. So, you know, for the Jays, yeah, things have changed. Obviously, there's been a ton that's happened. But this is the same core in a lot of ways. And so to your point, they haven't made the most of that core. This was supposed to be a core that would project for years into the future. And some of those players just have kind of emerged as maybe they're not core players. Like at this point, Alek Manoa, which, you know, we can get to, he's not central necessarily to what's happened on the field with the Blue Jays so far this season, but he's still got to figure out a way to throw more strikes than balls before he can re-enter that core. And he's going to start on Saturday at AAA. We'll see what that looks like. But step one, he has to throw more strikes than balls. Has not been doing that of late. So, you know, that's a question for them. Even Alejandro Kirk, you look at a guy right now with a 360 OPS, and I get it, he's been used a lot more than the Blue Jays would ideally use him, but man, he's just hammering everything into the ground. They have got to find a way that with the new hitting structure and all this effort and analysis being put into hitting, he's got to find a way to loft that ball up in the air, because he's one of the slowest runners in baseball. He can't be running a 54% ground ball rate. So, you know, some of these core players have taken steps or half steps back. Doesn't mean they can't take them forward again, but at this point, you know, there are some questions there.
Let's talk about Manoa since we're here, and we're going to see him again on Saturday, as you mentioned, for AAA Buffalo, and it's going to be very interesting to see just what the results look like against those hitters, because the results against single-A hitters last weekend look rather salty.
0-2 to Smith. He takes inside, and it's a hit by pitch. Manoa throws out his arms. He shows Zach Kovic that he thinks that Smith leaned into the pitch. He thought he swung at it. Here comes Jose Mayorga, and that's going to be all for Alek Manoa. And Mayorga takes the baseball from the rehabbing right-hander. Manoa gets a nice ovation from the crowd here at TD Ballpark as he heads back to the dugout after an inning and two-thirds. He allows 7 earned runs as it stands right now.
Manoa went 1 2/3, allowed 5 hits, 7 runs, 6 earned. He walked 4. He struck out 2. He threw 58 pitches, only 26 of them for strikes. 18 of his first 20 pitches in the game were balls. And if you take out a bunt attempt, he actually didn't get a swing until the 5th batter of the game. He threw 28 pitches in his first inning, 30 in his second, which he didn't complete. He hit his final batter with an 0-2 slider. And this is against a lineup with teenagers in it, like literal teenagers in it. And sure, like one of them's Max Clark, who's, you know, a name that you're going to know in like 2 to 3 years. He's going to be the next Jackson Holiday. But still, like, this is a lineup that Alek Manoa should be dominating. We're talking about a Cy Young finalist a couple of years ago, and he is just not in the zone against a single A lineup. He is allowing really hard hit balls when players are swinging and putting his balls in play. 3 balls in play at 100 miles per hour or harder, including a double and a homer. There is so much riding on this start in AAA this weekend, Ben. Like, Alek Manoa needs to be in the zone. He needs to have better control and command. He needs to show better against these AAA hitters. Otherwise, like, the Blue Jays just have a huge problem on their hands.
You know, they need the pitching too, right? Like, we're going to see how Bowden Francis does against the Rockies on Saturday. He's going to get that chance to start. And look, Rockies away from Coors, that is about as good a pitching matchup as you're going to find. So hopefully for Bowden Francis's sake and the Blue Jays, he's able to get on track. But whether it's that spot or something else, there's going to be a need for starting pitching. So clearly Manoah's progression bears watching and is really important for this team. And so, like you said, when he's not locating, that is a problem. And, you know, I find that, honestly, like, hearing Ross Atkins talk about it and hearing John Schneider talk about it, to me there's like this weird dissonance where these guys are saying, like, yeah, like, we really like his stuff and we're really encouraged with the way he's throwing, and like almost like going like indexing kind of hard on how impressed they are. But you look at the line score and, you know, just the basic facts of the outing when it comes to walks, hit by pitches, strikes, balls, clearly he doesn't have command. If he has the stuff, like, and he was up to 96, so if he has the stuff and if the slider's breaking more, that is in a way a good first step. But you can't overlook the fact that stuff is really only part of the equation here. And, you know, we can name countless examples of this, whether it's, you know, Nate Pearson right now or Aaron Sanchez at times or all kinds of pitchers with the Blue Jays and elsewhere who have had stuff. But if you can't command it, it truly doesn't matter. It just, because it's a ball. It's a ball out of the hand. The hitters see that. They don't swing, even a Class A. So, you know, for Manoah, it doesn't really matter to me if the stuff is good, because 96 is not enough. He has to be throwing it over the plate consistently.
Yeah, and teenagers and early 20s hitters at high A, not exactly known for their discipline, not exactly known right. for their selectivity. Like, this is a class of hitters that are often rather aggressive and rather swing happy. So, like, it really says something to me that, like, he did not get a swing until the fifth batter of the game. And look, he's throwing on Hawkeye, so, like, we can see the pitch chart and it looks like he's just missing a ton arm side, you know? So that's yeah. into righties away from lefties. It kind of points to something mechanical, something in his delivery, if that is, like, where he's continually missing, just in that area. So I guess you can have some optimism that that is something that could be ironed out. That is something that, like, pitching coaches and developers can work with him on, and he can just get to some cues and get to some things that he reminds himself of on the mound so that he could be more consistently in the zone. Because, like, I see what the Blue Jays are saying. Look, he was sitting 94 with his fastball, as you said, up to 96. Some of the sliders that he threw, like, had that break that he needs on it, like that break that was absent last year. His spin rates are up across the board. So, like, the stuff issue seems to have been solved. But yeah, there's clearly seems to be some sort of a mechanical issue, a tempo issue, something in his delivery that is stopping him from locating that stuff and from commanding it and getting the swings that he needs to, whether that's for whiffs or for soft contact. So, I mean, that's why I'm just going to have, like, such a keen eye on his outing this weekend, whether or not he's in the zone, whether or not he's getting swings, like his tempo on the mound, how quickly he's working, like all of that plays into it here. Because, you know, you're right, there is some fluidity at the back of the Blue Jays rotation, and we haven't even, I don't even want to say this, but we haven't even run into the point yet where somebody's shoulder barks or somebody gets a comebacker and has to miss a start or whatever, right? Like, the Blue Jays haven't had a health issue really in their rotation, you know, or their bullpen, aside from obviously Swanson or Romano, to this point. And you have to assume that that will be coming. So the Blue Jays are going to need their pitching depth, and they were counting on Alek Manoah being a part of that this year.
To me, the one number that I just want to know coming out of that Saturday start, and of course I'll look for more than one number, but if I was limited to one, it would just be strikes and balls, because you cannot be an effective major league starting pitcher and throw more balls than strikes. It is impossible. It is just not possible. So he has to change that. And if not, then at the end of his 30-day rehab window, which he's currently about 5 days into as we record this, then you would just have to option him and let him keep working through it. He has to throw strikes consistently to be a viable major league option.
Right, but then you look at the other depth options that the Blue Jays have, and like Yariel Rodriguez, very intriguing, but not somebody who's going to turn a lineup over three times. Like, yep. Maybe two trips through, but like there are very limited bullets that the Blue Jays have with Rodriguez this year, just considering the fact that he pitched so little last year while he was waiting to become a free agent, after which he signed with the Blue Jays. So like Yariel Rodriguez isn't going to be out here like Chris Bassett throwing 115 pitches. And then you look at, you know, Paulo Espino, who right now is in the Blue Jays bullpen and can go long, certainly. And everyone knows I love Paulo Espino, but like we are talking about an 88, 89 mile per hour fastball and a guy with a huge curveball and a guy whose location and command has to be absolutely pinpoint and precise for him to be successful at the big league level. Otherwise, like the damage is going to be considerable. And beyond him, you're talking about a Mitch White, who's basically pitching mop up out of the Blue Jays bullpen right now. And I mean, I don't even know. Am I missing somebody who we could also put into that like depth starter conversation? Yeah. Maybe a Tiedemann, but it doesn't feel like Tiedemann's particularly close just based on the results to this point in the season.
Agreed. You know, they traded Wes Parsons, of course, good deal for the Jays. You basically have Manoah trying to climb those ranks. I think at this point, he's probably toward the bottom of those options for the reasons that we've been talking about. And he clearly has way more upside than a lot of those guys, but he is going to have to climb past a Paulo Espino, because I think right now, you know, the way things are trending, you're going to go to Paulo Espino first. You're going to go to a bullpen game first and have Trevor Richards throw a couple innings, because he is Manoah right now. He has tons of upside, not writing anything off here, not saying it can't happen in the future, but at this point, he's trying to get to the point of being a viable major league starter. He's not currently there.
And that's the reason why, like, I think that there is so much pressure on the Blue Jays pitching staff right now, because, and we will get to this, I'm sure, but the offense for this club has not exactly clicked to start the season. It's not exactly been firing on all cylinders. Pretty encouraging process there, but the results haven't really followed to this point. So it's really been incumbent on the Blue Jays pitching staff to keep the club in games. And the first couple turns through the rotation, we saw a little bit of shakiness here and there. Like Yusei Kikuchi battled his command a little bit, and Chris Bassett's first couple outings, obviously not up to the standard that he's set for himself. I mean, Kevin Gausman looked great his first time out in a pretty limited sample as he was still getting built up. Second time out, Velo was absent, and the splitter wasn't carrying the zone and getting the whiffs that he needs it to be getting, and he wasn't in the counts that he needs to be in to use that splitter effectively. So it'll be interesting to see just what he looks like his next time out. Then obviously Bowden Francis has had a couple of rough ones to start his time in the Blue Jays rotation here against a very stiff competition, much easier assignment on hand this weekend with Colorado Rockies coming to town. But you take like that, what's going on in the rotation, and you add on the lack of trusted leverage options in the bullpen right now with Swanson and Romano unavailable. And I just think there's a ton of pressure on the pitching staff right now to allow the Blue Jays to stay in games and win games. I mean, without some of the, like, you know, without the Chris Bassett performance, without Jose Berríos looking like an ace, without Kikuchi bouncing back, without like some of the performances out of the bullpen from Trevor Richards and Jimmy Garcia in huge spots, the Blue Jays record would look a lot different today than it does as we sit here now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they've needed that pitching for sure. I mean, shout out to Jimmy Garcia. Wow, does he ever look good.
2-2. Swing and a miss. Went with the breaking ball, and he strikes out the side.
The two innings that he threw in that game the Blue Jays lost on Wednesday to the Mariners, just dominant. I mean, comes in, strikes out four of the six batters he faces. He's also, like, you think about, hey, the Jays are facing the Yankees, you know, which they will next week again, and it's Aaron Judge up. Like, Jimmy Garcia to me is like, you're never comfortable against Aaron Judge. You never want to be facing Aaron Judge, but like, Jimmy Garcia is kind of one of the rare guys where you're like, yep, that's actually a pretty good matchup for the Jays. He's just been really, really good. That's a low-key good contract for this team over the last few years. He's probably poised to actually get another really nice contract, just the way he's been going. But in the meantime, such an important reliever for the Blue Jays on a day that Chad Green, who's also been good, but Chad Green was you know, not available for the team. And then you get to Tim Mayza, and, you know, Tim Mayza has been so consistent for this team, low key, you know, incredible season last year, really underappreciated and underrated across the league. And then he comes into this season and he doesn't have his velo. His velo was down a couple miles per hour out, and he blew the game to on a homer to Cal Raleigh on Wednesday. Obviously, really tough one for the Jays. And for Mayza, Shai and I talked to him after the game, and he was kind of, you know, just acknowledging, like, I'm searching for this. I've had a terrible start. Like, that's his word, was terrible. And we all know how effective and consistent Tim Mayza has been. But, man, he is a long way from that right now. And he knows it, and he's wearing it. But that's a challenge for the Jays as well.
That's just part of this pitching staff being stress tested right now. You know, Chris Bassitt alluded to it earlier this week and saying that he was disappointed in the starters, and, you know, put himself first and foremost in that conversation.
I'll be honest with you, I've been pretty disappointed in our starters so far. And I think, obviously, this is my third start. Two of my starts were terrible, in my opinion. So I'm no help to the problem. But I just think the biggest thing for us is just getting our starters going. I know I'm so confident in all the guys we have. It's just the first 10, 11 games have been pretty rough for us, to be honest with you, outside of Berrios. So, yeah, just get our starters going. Give the bullpen guys some time off and don't have them like eating so many innings, so to speak.
Look, like, Jose Berrios, no questions. He's been an ace this year. Bassitt, Kikuchi bounced back nicely. We'll see what happens with Gausman and Francis. But beyond them, you get to a bullpen where the trust tree for John Schneider and Pete Walker in leverage right now is essentially Jimmy Garcia, Chad Green, and I guess Trevor Richards on occasion. I mean, he looked rough at times in spring, but I mean, he's been good so far in the regular season. But they also use him as, like, low-key, like, a length guy, a bulk guy. Like, he'll go out there and throw 30 pitches. Beyond that, I don't know how much trust there is in leverage for guys like Genesis Cabrera, as you mentioned, Mayza, Nate Pearson, and then you got the two long guys in Mitch White and Paulo Espino. So, like, the Blue Jays pitching staff is just walking this, like, tightrope until the offense, you know, shows up for the season and starts scoring some more runs, where, like, starters have to be near perfect, like, really can't give up that many runs. And if you are, like, handing over slim leads to the bullpen in the fifth or sixth inning, it's going to be tough to get that thing to the finish line without Romano and Swanson on hand, like, because, like, when you just look at the results and you look at the situations that Schneider and Walker have been putting certain relievers into, when it comes to leverage time, they don't have a ton of options. And that's why you see, like, a Chris Bassitt coming back out with his pitch count, like, in triple digits to throw another inning.
Yeah, it's kind of cool when that happens. And, you know, I wouldn't say that if they were doing that with Ricky Tiedemann on the mound. I do think there's a difference if a guy's gotten paid or not. And beyond the money, too, is Chris Bassitt understands his body differently and better than a 21-year-old probably possibly could. So I like that the Blue Jays gave Chris Bassitt that extra length. And they also, he had an extra day going into that start, and he has an extra day coming out of that start because of the off day. So I think that's totally fine. I like seeing pitchers pushed a little bit, you know, within reason there. But at the same time, yeah, that to your overall point, the pitching staff has been taxed. And I think the trust tree, so to speak, is as small as you suggested. I think it's essentially Jimmy Garcia and Chad Green. And Trevor Richards gets some leverage innings, and Tim Mayza has gotten some leverage innings, but that's about it. I think it's really those two guys that they truly trust, and kind of understandably so. And, you know, on the one hand, you look at the relievers and you say, okay, well, they're without their two best relievers, so how many bullpens look good when you're down your two best relievers? It's not going to be many. But at the same time, pitchers get hurt, and that's a, you know, huge discussion in the game right now. I'm not sure if you have a lot of thoughts on that one, Arden, but it's not a shock exactly when pitchers do get hurt. So it is incumbent on these teams and organizations to create as much possible pitching depth at a high level as possible.
And even when Eric Swanson, Jordan Romano return, which, like, could be as soon as this weekend with the Rockies in town, like, we'll see. Those guys are both pitching for Buffalo here on Thursday, and, like, we don't know yet how that how that has gone. But, you know, I think that if Swanson has a good outing, he could be back this weekend. And with Romano, I mean, it's his first rehab appearance. So the Blue Jays will have to make a decision about whether they want him to have another one or whether he could come straight back. But if all goes well there, I mean, the Yankees series at the latest for Romano as a target. So like that's going to help. But when those guys come back, I mean, if they throw 20 pitches one night, I don't know that you're going to see them the next night, just with like how little they've pitched to this point, the injuries they've dealt with, how they've been built up. As you mentioned, you know, the injury rash across baseball for pitchers, the Blue Jays wanted to be cautious there, wanted to be careful. Like that's one of the main reasons why I was surprised to see Bassett come back out, was just the, you know, you need this guy in September, right? It's not just April. It's why like the Berríos pull the day prior that John Schneider was booed for was like completely fine and completely defensible and completely the right thing to do. Like one of many reasons why that was the right thing to do was because you need to like conserve some, like you can't put that much workload on your starters here in early April. You're gonna burn them out. Like these are guys who you want pitching postseason games for you 6 months from now, so you have to err on the side of caution and you have to be conservative. But the push-pull of that is John Schneider not having a lot in the bullpen most nights and having to ask a Chris Bassett to throw 115.
It's a big ask to make. And so it is a good thing that the rotation's been really strong. I thought Yusei Kikuchi on Wednesday looked great. And we've seen a lot of really good Yusei Kikuchi starts in the last, I guess, year plus now. He just looks really good. I mean, again, that's a really good deal for the Blue Jays, that three-year contract. When he heads into free agency, he's going to be a very coveted pitcher. And look, you know, signing free agent pitchers is only one part of the equation. But yeah, Kikuchi, Bassett, Jimmy, these guys have been, Gausman, of course, they've been successes. It's just that, you know, some of those internal players, like we're talking about, like a Kirk or a Manoa, or the many nameless draft picks who never surface in the major leagues and won't get anywhere close. So, you know, internally, they haven't necessarily made the most of their opportunities, but the free agent stuff has been good, especially with respect to those pitchers.
And, you know, Jose Berríos deserves to be in that conversation as well, as just like pitchers who have carried the staff to this point. Like one of the reasons why the Blue Jays are 6-7. I mean, he, like Berríos has just been elite this year. You look at what he did against the Mariners with a 38% called strike and whiff rate. I mean, that's just incredible. He's using his sinker to both sides of the plate effectively. He's landing the sinker in the zone. He's getting swing and miss with the slurve. Like he's staying away from the heart of the plate. He's staying away from that four seamer against lefties, which has been like a big problem for him in the past. He's got the cutter now, which is replacing some of those four seamers against lefties, so allowing less damage to that side of the platoon. I do think that going forward, Berríos is going to need to strike some more hitters out. Otherwise, he is due for a rather big correction on balls in play. Like you look at his ERA right now, and it's 1.45, but his expected ERA is 6.68. So, look, Berríos is never going to be like a 30% strikeout guy, but the rate that he's striking guys out at now is too low. He's below 20% right now. He needs to be back up towards the like 23-24% he's averaged over his career. If he continues to allow this many balls in play, I do think that there is a correction coming, but you really can't argue with what Berríos has done to this point or the stuff that he showed.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, if someone was had a 6.6 something expected ERA and they're throwing 88-89 and they don't really have an out pitch, like a, you know, not to pick on your guy, but like let's say Paolo Espino had that kind of number, then you might be like, yeah, I don't know if I want him starting every 5 days. But watching Berríos, he's throwing 95-96, like you said, locating to both sides of the plate. Great breaking ball. I mean, that breaking ball's been really good. It was excellent against the Mariners, getting some off-balance swings. And, you know, he's got the weapons. So to me, this is one of those cases where I look at that, you know, quote-unquote advanced stat and just honestly dismiss it. And it doesn't really change my opinion of who Jose Berríos is. It's interesting, but it doesn't fundamentally shift my confidence level in what he can do.
Yeah, I think it's just because he's not striking enough guys out. His strikeout rate right now is well below his average over his career. So he should be able to get that back up. And as we both said, he has the stuff to be able to get that back up. So yeah, like you, little concern with Jose Berríos, but I did think it was worth mentioning. Before we take the break, you kind of mentioned it earlier. Did you want to make a comment on just pitcher injuries, like some of the big names that we're seeing hitting the IL, just this topic that has been omnipresent through the first couple weeks of the MLB season.
I'll try to be concise here. I think that essentially it's a little bit of a media-driven topic to some extent. I think also there's a little bit of player fear driving this as well. And I say that respectfully. I understand these careers are short and players should be careful with their careers. And, you know, it makes sense to be really vigilant against something like the pitch clock shortening to 18 seconds and making sure that you're not putting pitchers' health at risk in making a rule change like that. At the same time, it was a collectively bargained change, or at least the possibility of those changes was collectively bargained. And there was research that went into those possibilities before they were implemented. And I just look at it and I think, you know what? No one was talking about this 5 weeks ago, and no one will be talking about it 5 weeks from now. It's just that in early in the season, pitchers come to camp, they are hurt already. And so that those injuries reveal themselves as pitchers try to ramp up and those injuries get exposed. So I just, and then again, it happens late in the season as new injuries come up and pitchers respond to the fatigue of the season by getting hurt. So to me, I don't think this is something that we're going to keep seeing at this rate throughout May and throughout June. It's just happening now because it's the ramp up of the season. It sucks. It's devastating. It's definitely something we need to look at. But as long as velo is incentivized to the extent that it is in baseball, I don't see it changing. And so, you know, to me, I look at it and it's not good, but I think it's a little bit of a moment in time. And I think that it's not way worse now than it was 2 years ago or 4 years ago. It's more of a gradual thing that happens as velocity is prioritized in the game.
Yeah, I don't know that we're seeing a different quantity of pitcher injuries this year. I think you're seeing a different quality of pitcher who is being injured this year,
right?
Like a Yuri Perez and a Spencer Strider, like a Framber Valdez. Like, just think that there's... Right, like a lot more name brand dudes are going down, but like, you're right, we see this every year early in the season where there is a concentration of pitcher injuries as guys like get their arms going again and start throwing intensely again, and things start going wrong. And like, as you mentioned, you know, like everyone is able to identify the problem here. It's not like some mystery that throwing max effort, max velo, max spin, max intensity, 90 times every 5 days. That probably has something to do with this. You know, pitchers are pushing themselves harder than ever. Extreme approaches get extreme results in all facets of life. And that goes both ways with pitching, right? An extreme approach to pitching will result in extreme velocity, extreme spin, extreme break, just gonna help you like strike a bunch of dudes out and put up some really gaudy numbers. But an extreme approach will also result in extreme pressure and stress and toll on the body that we know produces injury. There's obviously no putting this toothpaste back in the tube. You know, as you kind of referred to, like, MLB self-selects for the nastiest dudes. If you want to spend your entire career in the minors or maybe not even be drafted at all, then you can just not throw as hard as you can, right? Like, you can not throw pitches with good pitch characteristics. You cannot have nasty stuff. Congratulations, you're not a big leaguer. The incentives are so great that, of course, pitchers are going to pursue this and chase velocity and break at all costs. And also the flip side of that, like, hitters are so good these days at creating damage on slower, less dynamic pitches that anyone who isn't throwing super hard, like anybody who's below a certain like velocity or movement threshold, is just going to get absolutely hammered at the big league level and filtered out of the highest levels of competition. So like, this is just the nature of the beast, and it's been this way for several years. I just think that, you know, you have a lot of name brand guys who have gone down to injury this year, and that's why it has been as big of a topic as it's been.
Yeah, exactly. So it's no single thing. It's not just that the pitch clock has been implemented, and MLB isn't about to disincentivize velocity. It's not like they're about to say, hey, everything over 97 is a ball. Like, that would change things, but they're not going to do that. You know, so they, you know, that's not going to be, you know, a front burner topic. So I think here we are. It's, you know, of course we want to see all the advances we can as far as health and arm care for pitchers and making sure that no one's pushing themselves unnecessarily hard. But man, that's a tough thing to enforce.
I'll give you two quick solutions. Let me know what you think about this, because everybody's identifying the problem. It's easy to identify the problem. I don't see a lot of solutions out there. So here's two quick solutions from Arden's crazy lab of ideas. Number one, if we're going to, like, if you're going to increase the stress on the arms as much as pitchers are, then you also need to increase the recovery. Like, you need to take more time in between starts if you are going to throw every pitch at maximal effort and intensity. So I believe that MLB clubs should go to six-man rotations. They already do it in Japan. A ton of minor league clubs obviously do it. Like, organizations are already doing this in the minors with developing pitchers. As we said, like you can't ask athletes to try less hard. Like, you can't ask them to throw slower. So if you're going to stress your arm as much as you are, then you're going to need to let it recover more. So I think that my first solution would be six-man rotations across MLB just to allow pitchers to recover better between outings.
Now, is that mandated, or is that something, like, is that MLB mandated?
I don't know if there's a way to do it like that, but I think that if you're a club and you're trying to keep your pitchers as healthy as possible, it's something you should strongly consider.
Yeah, I mean, MLB could say something like, anytime a pitcher throws 75 pitches, he must have 5 days of rest afterwards.
Yeah.
Now, does that lead? There's always the threshold question, because then does that mean that teams take guys out at 74 and, you know, all of a sudden they're out there 3 days later? What about the playoffs? You know, are there, you know, there, what about spring training? How do you account for off-season training? It's an interesting idea. So let's hear the second one.
All right, number two would be MLB mandated. And that would be just easing the regular season schedule. Like, do it like you do in the minors. Six-game series played in one ballpark Tuesday through Sunday. Every team is off on Monday. Fewer games in the regular season. It doesn't need to be 162. We're not going down to like 82 or something. It could be 140 something, whatever. But just like lessen the travel, lessen the demands on the body, play fewer like random midweek day games, following night games, which are then followed by extensive travel, hopping around time zones, getting in at all hours and not sleeping and not recovering. Like, MLB's just relentless schedule of games every day and constant travel and oscillating start times, like, this just is not giving modern day players adequate time to recover. And we know that fatigue is highly correlated to injury. So ease the schedule and perhaps you would see fewer injuries.
Yeah, that's my mind goes to collective bargaining there. And the owners are never going to suggest that. So then the players have to be the ones to push that through. And then what concessions do the owners expect if the players are taking lopping 18 games off the schedule or whatever the case? Like, it's not, I'm not saying it would be ineffective, because I'm sure it would nudge things in the right direction, but getting that through a negotiation would be tough.
No, ultimately, revenues are increasing. Popularity is increasing. Like, the sport continues to make more money. Everybody's getting rich. So there really isn't an incentive there for MLB owners to do anything differently.
Yeah.
Let's step away. But when we come back, we ought to talk about this Blue Jays offense, what we're seeing from it so far, whether or not we think it's going to show up in a more dynamic way or not going forward. All that and so much more when we continue on At the Letters.
Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith, our producer this week, Shoali, and Ben, it's time for the razor-thin margin of the week. It's been a theme this year. I think it's going to be a theme all season long for this team, is just how razor thin the margins are in baseball. You know what the difference is between the Blue Jays being 7-6 right now and above 500 versus 6-7 and below 500, which is where they are, is a matter of inches in the ninth inning on Wednesday. And you can start with Alejandro Kirk absolutely smoking a ball off Andrés Muñoz early in that ninth inning, 100 miles per hour off the bat, 470 expected batting average, right into Mitch Haniger's glove, but then you can go to the Ernie Clement looper off of Munoz later in that inning, which just falls into Jorge Polanco's glove. Great play by the Mariners second baseman, but the expected batting average on that Clement ball, 750. A hit probability of 75%. If Polanco is positioned one more step to his right, or if he doesn't get as good of a jump, if he's just a tick slower of a runner, that ball falls in. Everyone's celebrating. The Blue Jays are dumping water all over each other and jumping around and celebrating. And Ernie Clement's the walk-off hero, and it's 7-6 for the Blue Jays and happy days. But that's not what happened. And then the bullpen came in, and we saw what did happen. That is your razor-thin margin of the week.
When that ball left the bat, I was writing the game story for Sportsnet.ca that week. And as the ball is in the air, my mind is like, all right, here we go. I have to write this in like 30 seconds before, you know, I head downstairs to talk to John Schneider and the players. And, of course, the ball is caught, and the whole narrative spins right there. And, yeah, Clement did a good job to get a bat on the ball. Great play by Polanco in that situation. That's not an easy play. And, yeah, it's fair. I mean, ultimately, there are so many plays like that in the course of a game and even in the course of a season. And I think that over time, the bounces add up and they end up being fair. And that's kind of the nice thing. We talked a little earlier about, hey, what if they shorten the schedule a little bit? In the end, baseball is a game of so many reps that they are going to have bounces that go their way. And there will be times that those hits glance off the gloves of the fielders they're playing against. And unfortunately for them, Wednesday wasn't one of those times. But there will be other times where that evens out.
And this is the thing with the Blue Jays offense, is I think they're getting themselves into good positions to score runs and good positions to do damage. They then just aren't doing the whole score runs and do damage part. Like, they just aren't squaring up enough baseballs. The Blue Jays among the lowest in the league in hard hit rate, lowest in the league in average exit velocity, lowest in the league in barrels. Like, we're just not seeing enough of those big swings that you need to take advantage of the opportunities that they're getting themselves in. Like, look, that Ernie Clement looper is like a pretty good example. 65 miles per hour off the bat, right? Like, did not square that up. If he does square that pitch up and it finds grass, yeah, that game's over, right? If, like, Kirk did square a ball up, just didn't find grass, it was just hit right at a fielder. Ernie Clement, by the way, somebody who the book is very much out on across baseball. This is a guy who is, like, can't buy a fastball right now since he got off to that hot start this year. You know, over, like, his last eight games, he's seen less than 46% fastballs. Like, he's among the bottom of the league in fastball scene. There is an adjustment that needs to be made there. But, like, I do think that just overall, the Blue Jays' approach has been pretty sound in getting themselves into those situations to do damage. This is a, like, top five team in chase rates, or, you know, bottom five, whatever, but, like, on the good side, top five of chase rate, contact rate, top five, like, swing and strike rate, top five, walks to strikeouts, 3-1 counts seen. I mean, all of those approach indicators, all of those metrics, like pitches per plate appearance and walk rate and swinging strike rate, all this stuff, the Blue Jays are among the league leaders. Like, I do think they're doing good things at the plate as a team. They're just lacking those big swings. They're just not taking advantage of those opportunities that they're creating for themselves. As you mentioned, baseball's a large sample sport. We see so much of it, 162 games. You believe that that will come around with time if that process remains consistent, but that doesn't make it any less frustrating for fans to watch the offense right now fail to come through in those spots.
Yeah, and, you know, I think there are some players where you kind of think, okay, well, it's going to turn around. And certainly when you look at the collective, you can say, you know, this is a team too that is, you know, has one of the lowest batting averages on balls in play in all of Major League Baseball as we record this on Thursday. Now, partly that's maybe a product of not hitting the ball very hard. Partly there's some bad luck in there, like the Polanco grab on Ernie Clement. A lot of the time that will be a hit. And then I look at individual players and sometimes they might be putting themselves in good counts, but they're not taking advantage of it. And I mentioned earlier the ground ball rate that Alejandro Kirk has Kevin Kiermaier is running a 71% ground ball rate. Vladdy's ground ball rate is close to 50%. So you want to see hitters, once they get into good counts, you want to see them hitting the ball in the air, whether it's a line drive or a fly ball. And, you know, you don't want to see guys just hammering it into the ground. As a team, the Blue Jays have been doing a lot of that, and especially some of their key players. So I do think that there are, you know, some adjustments to be made, whether those are mental or mechanical or physical, whatever the case. That's for Don Mattingly to figure out. But they need to do more once they're actually in these counts.
If ever there was a team to get right against, it is the Colorado Rockies this weekend. They enter with the league's worst ERA, 6.57 as a club to this point in the season. Number two, like the second worst, is the LA Angels at 5.09. So we're talking a run and a half worse than the second worst pitching club this year. This is, you know, a top 10 club in terms of like hard hit rate allowed and a barrel rate and like all these things that we look at. They have given up a ton of damage. They have not gotten very good pitching performances. They aren't striking anybody out. They have the lowest K per nine across baseball. They're walking a ton of hitters. They have the second highest walks per nine across baseball, and they're giving up a ton of home runs as well. So this would be a good time for the Blue Jays to finally start seeing some results for all of their good process to this point.
Yeah, you can never like bank on a sweep. Like a sweep should be on the table. You know, it shouldn't, it's not like a reach to think that they could sweep here either. They have to win this series. Like, and I'm not saying like it's must win, obviously, like they, whatever, they could lose the series, that's fine. But like, they really should win this series. This is like a bad team. This is not a good team. And they're on the road too, which, you know, the Rockies obviously have somewhat of a relative advantage at home because the conditions are so different and because they're more used to those very different conditions. But on the road, I mean, this is just such a beatable team. So if you're the Jays, you got to go in there trying to win a sweep, of course, and as they do every series, so it doesn't necessarily change a lot in their approach. But from the outside looking in, that's an actual achievable possibility. And yeah, it's not every day you get to face a team like this, right? I don't want to sound dismissive when I say this, but like, you know, there aren't a lot of like dumb GMs in baseball. And, you know, I'm not, and the Rockies, you know, the Rockies have some smart people in their organization as well, but it seems as though with their challenges at altitude and, you know, their some of the ways that they've made decisions, they do lag behind other teams in baseball. And so this is a real chance for the Blue Jays to go out there and take advantage against a team that does not win consistently and certainly has had a lot of trouble trying to field a competitive team.
What do you think that opposition batters are hitting against the Rockies this year?
Ooh, batting average. Well, I'd want to know. Okay, batting average. Well, I'll say it's 276.
That would be so much if it was 276. It's not 276. It's 294. Teams are hitting nearly 300 against the Rockies this year. That's what we're that's what we're looking at this weekend at Rogers Center. Two wins has to be the bare minimum expectation, but truly a series that the Blue Jays should be sweeping. Like you said, not a good team regardless of where it's playing, but certainly not a good team away from its ballpark. And you are missing like the good part of their rotation as much as there even is a good part of their rotation. Following the Rockies into town after this weekend is the Yankees. And then you got to fly across to the West Coast to play the Padres, who have as much talent as any team in baseball. So gotta be at bare minimum two wins on the weekend, but realistically a series the Blue Jays can and should sweep.
You know, you can bet that John Schneider, he's not going to say that. No one would ever say that publicly. There's just way more downside than upside. But behind the scenes, of course, they're thinking that too. They need to get every win they can with the Yankees coming into town. Like you said, this is a good chance for them to do that.
John Schneider does say some things publicly. He talks publicly every day. It's like the hardest part of being a manager, I think, honestly, is having to like be on the record for 10, 15, 20 minutes every single day. You were just exposed to so many opportunities to put your foot in your mouth. And I think like John Schneider actually is one of the better public spokespeople among MLB managers. I think it's really like a strength of his. He's very thoughtful. Like, he's very insightful. He always really like explains his decision-making, I find, really well, and gives like really well articulated reasons for why things are happening. He has a great knowledge of like what's going on within the organization and within the system, minor league play. Like, he's not one of these managers who's like, I only know the 26 guys who are in my clubhouse. Like, John Schneider can...
Yeah, maybe previous managers might have had a different approach there, like John Gibbons, that's for sure.
Heard that one once or twice before, but yeah, and he also articulates like the injury stuff really well. I can talk about the medical side of it really well. A lot of managers who can't do that side of it very well, etc. This is all to say, though, like, John Schneider did say some things about Cal Raleigh last year, essentially saying that he's not difficult to pitch to if you execute. You know, he's got a lot of power potential, but also a lot of strikeout potential as well. He's hitting 200, and you know, Cal Raleigh heard that and remembered it after he went deep against the Blue Jays off of Tim Mesa on Wednesday. And Raleigh said afterwards, quote, I know a lot of guys have beef with him being Schneider, in the league. So his comments aren't surprising. I don't have much to say. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all if you don't want it to come back on you. End quote. Your thoughts, Ben, on the bubbling rivalry and beef between the Blue Jays, the Mariners, their coaches, their catchers, and everything in between.
Whatever I think, whatever John Schneider thinks, whatever anyone listening thinks, Cal Raleigh's the one who has the last laugh here. I mean, he has absolutely destroyed the Blue Jays. You look at the numbers. He's only played the Blue Jays 15 games. He has 9 home runs and 16 RBI. And then that's not even including the playoffs. Once you get to the playoffs, 2 more games, another home run against the Blue Jays from 2022. So, you know, and
Ryan Mountcastle West.
Oh, Ryan Mountcastle wishes he had Cal Raleigh's numbers against the Blue Jays. Like, it is... This is like a Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds is not even at this level. Like, he's got a 793 slugging percentage. Yeah, he does strike out a lot. The Blue Jays have struck him out a lot. But Raleigh obviously hit that home run in the 2022 playoffs when the Mariners swept the Blue Jays. And then the next spring is when John Schneider says he's not that tough to pitch to. And like, John Schneider, I agree with you with everything you said. He's very good at explaining his thought process. But look, at that point in time, he was probably, you know, it was post game. He was probably a little frustrated with his relievers, and he was probably a little frustrated with Cal Raleigh, and makes a remark that's like kind of poking the bear a little bit. And it's part of sports. To me, I'm not reading too much into this. It's part of sports. It's part of entertainment. I find it entertaining. You know, I'm not the one giving up the home runs. I'm sure that for Tim Mesa, it's not that fun. For Cal Raleigh, like, good for him. Honestly, like, he's not doing anything wrong. He's just showing up to work and mashing against the Blue Jays. So it's hard to really fault him for anything here. I don't put this on John Schneider either, but if you're going to make that kind of public comment as the manager of the Blue Jays, you can bet that that's going to get back to the player. In this case, it backfired. There's nothing that didn't help the Blue Jays. I'm not saying it hurt them, but there's no way that that comment helped the Blue Jays. I'm not saying, oh my God, John Schneider should stop talking. And this is like, oh, how dare he say that? Whatever. It's entertainment. That's fine. But yeah, Cal Raleigh's having the last laugh here.
It's so innocuous. Like, there's nothing in it. I do my job at field level for, 60, 70, 80 games a year. This pales in comparison to what is said between the lines in an MLB game. Trust me. Like, this is rather innocuous compared to some of the things that are exchanged between dugouts, between managers and umpires, between opponents. You know, things get really heated and emotional during an MLB game, I think a lot more so than comes through on TV. So, like, I think it's interesting, as you said. I think it's entertaining. There's never like anything wrong with a little bit of piss and vinegar. There's never anything wrong with a little bit of a rivalry and a little bit of a feud. Like, I think that makes it more fun for us in the media, for fans. It might make it more fun for the players, honestly, and for the managers. I've got to play 162 of these things. If they're all boring, if none of them have any juice in them, it would be kind of dull. So, that's as far as like my analysis of it goes, really. I think anyone who's like using this to suggest that like John Schneider is a bad manager, John Schneider is like doing harm to the Blue Jays, or this is why like John Schneider shouldn't be in that position, like you're just getting so far out over your skis, honestly. Like that is just such a stretch, in my opinion. I don't think that this quote that none of us even remembered until Cal Raleigh let us know that he was the one guy on earth who did remember it. I just don't think that this quote really says anything about John Schneider's job as manager of the Toronto Blue Jays and how good at it he is.
Yeah, there are way, way more important things to for him to be dealing with.
How do you think Blue Jays fans, and like we never know, right? You can't tell from the social media or from anything, right? How like there's no survey of the Blue Jays fan base, right? Like nobody calls Blue Jays fans and say, hey, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel about John Schneider? And then accumulates all those results and presents it for us in a tidy little graph. So we don't have any market research on this, but all I know is that when John Schneider was introduced at the home opener, and then when he went to get Jose Berríos for a pitching change, I would estimate about 60 to 70% of the 40,000 people there booed him. What do you think that kind of says about where John Schneider resides right now in the hearts and minds of Blue Jays fans?
Well, I take that to be the best barometer that we're going to get of how Blue Jays fans feel. And I take it, yeah, at face value, is that, hey, they're not thrilled with how things are going. They're frustrated. And I think that he is not the only person within that organization who frustrates Blue Jays fans at this moment. But there is no moment that Ross Atkins walks in front of 40,000 people and is introduced. And there's no moment when Mark Shapiro is, or when, you know, other members of the front office are. It's probably Atkins who would draw even more frustration, I would guess, than John Schneider if there was a moment that he was introduced to. It's just not the way introductions are done. No team introduces their GM on opening day of the season. And maybe for that reason, I take it to mean that John Schneider, it's part of his job. Again, going back to the public facing element of being a major league manager, he has to speak 2 times a day on the record. And he has to go out there in the uniform with his name on the back and face the music, whatever that is. So, yeah, I think that he receives a lot of frustration because Blue Jays fans are frustrated with the state of things. And he is a part of that. He is a big part of that. So that's my read on things.
I mean, you got Jose Berríos at like what? He's at 101 pitches, finishing his third trip through the order. He's about to face a lefty who got a hit off of him his last time up. The same lefty, Dominic Calzone, who like took Chris Bassett deep on his 108th pitch a night later. And, you know, Berríos's velo was down to 92, 93. It's only his third start of the year. Like, this is not a guy who typically goes 110. You've got like the Yuri Perez and Shane Bieber of it all, as we mentioned. Like, as a manager in that spot, I think you're making the best move to win the game. You got Jimmy Garcia throwing 100, bring him in. You have a bullpen and use it. Like, I think that was an incredibly defensible pull based on the facts of the situation, but clearly there is just a lot more at play here for the Blue Jays fan base.
Yeah, exactly. It's like pretty much literally like a triggering moment, right? It's like him taking Berríos out, and then it's, yeah, the fans are like, oh, we've seen this before and it went horribly, and they react, and that's their right. And I don't expect fans to be logical. It's not the job of a fan to have to sit there and be logical. Enjoy or boo or have whatever experience you want. You're a fan. That's why, you know, that's the right you earn once you pay that ticket, or once you dial up the game on game day or at Sportsnet or however you decide to follow along. So I have no problem with the fan reaction there. I think it's very understandable. But yeah, when you're looking at that tactically, it's like, I mean, it's just not even a thing. It's like, yeah, it's moving on. You know, I could not have less objection to that move. It's not a thing. But it's also like even the Davis Schneider thing, which I think happened just after we recorded last week. So you know, we don't need to go back and even relitigate that. But, you know, Davis Schneider has this big home run, and then, you know, that he's not in the starting lineup the next day. And there's this whole discussion about it. And look, if Davis Schneider hits, he's going to have his chances. Some of those chances are going to come when you expect. Some of them are going to come you know, when you don't expect it. It's a long season. To me, the time to go really granular and the time to really make a big deal of this is the playoffs. And that's why we did that entire podcast about the Berríos decision. But it's not game 10 or 11 or 12 of the regular season, because, you know, it's just a long game. You're going to have your reps. David Schneider's going to get his chances. Berríos is going to get his chances. You have to some extent, you have to play the long game here.
Oh, absolutely. And like, that's part of the reason why, like, in my estimation, in my opinion, like, John Schneider is a good manager. I think he makes the best possible decision. Like, I think that his decisions always have, like, what's best for this team in the short, medium, and long term in mind. Even the Berríos decision in the playoffs last year, like, he's trying to win a game doing that. And he's considering a lot of factors, a lot of variables, a lot of circumstances, but he believes, like, he is convicted in that moment. This is the right decision to win a game. And this is not somebody who is flying by the seat of his pants. Like, this is someone who is relentlessly prepared. Like, if anything, I think people would maybe criticize him for, like, trusting too much in the information or considering too much information while he's making decisions. But, like, this is a guy who understands modern analysis, like, understands how to pull insight and opinions from various pillars of the organization. As I said earlier, like, when you ask him about a move post game or the next day, like, he really does articulate his thinking and his strategy in a really deep and clear and thoughtful way. And he also has the humility, I find, to admit that, hey, I might have been wrong, or hey, I was wrong. Like, I think that he will admit that a lot of the in-game decisions he makes are not black and white. There are shades of gray here, and there are arguments to be made on both sides. And he's having those discussions with a DeMarlo Hale and with a Don Mattingly and with a Pete Walker in the Blue Jays dugout. Ultimately, he has to make the final call, but he admits when he's wrong. And he admits that he's not perfect and that he can be wrong. So I think that's really all you can ask for, is somebody who just considers all the information, makes what they believe is the best possible decision, and then owns it afterwards, just as I'm sure he's going to own the rally comments when he's asked about them. He's not going to hide from this. So, like, I do think, for all those reasons, and then also, like, the fact that, as I said, he's a very capable spokesperson, which is just such a massive part of his job, I think he actually is a good MLB manager, and I think that the Blue Jays are lucky to have him.
The part that I'm honestly not sure of, and I'm not trying to throw shade, I honestly don't know and probably can't really know, what's that interaction like with players? Is he able to get buy-in from them? Are players, you know, did they want to play for him, you know, in the way that, you know, the great managers get buy-in from players, and they're able to then have a few leaders build even more buy-in as maybe younger players come up and follow their lead? And, you know, that's a tough thing to tell from the outside. Certainly, you know, you think about the respect that, like, a Bruce Bochy or a Dusty Baker, you know, these guys, like, over time build up so much respect that then that allows them to proceed and maybe minimize conflicts, or, you know, get buy-in from players in difficult situations. That part is tough to tell, but I think tactically we can tell. And I think about tactics along with the game itself as the game is unfolding. You know, you and Shai and myself, David Singh, we're up there in the press box, we're maybe talking through, you know, what moves might happen, and he always has answers for that. I think tactically he's a very strong manager.
Yeah, we'll never know, right? But that EQ side of it is an incredibly important part of the job. Like, that's something that Kevin Cash gets a lot of credit for in Tampa, and that's a hard thing to do with the Rays when you got players who are in and out of the lineup and players who are in platoons, and they're playing different positions every day, and one day you're hitting third, the next day you're hitting eighth, and, like, you want to see some controversial pitching changes. I mean, like, the Rays have been doing that for years, just nobody pays as much attention. Like, the Rays don't have a market of 33 million people that they play for. Like, they don't have as much attention on them. The Blue Jays, like, low-key doing a lot of Raysy stuff when you look at the postseason last year, and then the way that they're running some of these platoons at second and third base this year. Cool, and the Rays do it, and then the Jays do it, and all of a sudden it's a problem. Just getting back to, you know, the Davis Schneider of it all there. But yeah, yeah, that's the part that like we can't know and that we'll never know is like the emotional intelligence side of it. I do think that like Schneider has good self-awareness and I do think he has good social awareness, but yeah, I don't know anything about like the relationship management and the ego management within his clubhouse. Like I have no idea about that, and I don't think I will ever have an idea about it, but I think you're right that it is a very important aspect of being a capable MLB manager.
Yeah, exactly. Like I think that, you know, clearly he's an affable individual, he's able to get along with people, that's clear. In like a regular environment, that's obvious. It's just that the baseball clubhouse is such an irregular environment, and you have such different power structures and such different egos and pay scales, and navigating that, and let's call it like it is, especially in, you know, this is his second full year as a manager. He didn't play in the major leagues, and you know, this is someone who hasn't won in the playoffs yet. And so if that changes, if he's able to win a World Series or get to the World Series the way Kevin Cash did, or, you know, win a World Series the way Dave Roberts did, then, you know, it's not like those guys were 7-time All-Stars like a Dom Mattingly, or Mattingly might have been an All-Star more than that. But you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, those guys were role players in the major leagues, and then they have had greater success as managers. And Jim Leland never played. Did Leland play in the major leagues? I don't think he did.
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, you can get that over time. And maybe he will get that. I think he has that potential to get there. And so, yeah, we'll see how all that unfolds. You know, he's got a pretty good team. You know, we'll see what they can do.
I'll tell you something. Like, if the Blue Jays do win anything, if they go to an ALCS or they go to a World Series, like, I mean, John Schneider it'll flip on a head, and he'll be beloved. And all of a sudden, it'll be, you know, homegrown guy who's been in the organization since the early 2000s, is a minor leaguer, climbed the ranks with the Biggios and the Bichettes and the Guerreros, like did his time in the minor leagues, like earned it. And now here he is like on a grander scale stage in the playoffs. And he's doing these avails with national reporters who are like, oh, wow, this guy's really thoughtful. Oh, wow, he gives really good quotes. Like, oh, wow, this guy's got a really interesting story. Let me tell it, because we're now paying attention to the Blue Jays because they're in the ALCS. Like, I do think that the perception of John Schneider will turn very quickly, just as it did with John Gibbons back 100%. In the day, who caught a ton of heat throughout like what 95% of his Blue Jays tenure, and then for the second half of 2015 became the most beloved manager this side of Cito Gaston.
Literally, yeah, like that's it. You just got to win. If you win, these problems solve themselves. I do want to fact check myself here. Dom Mattingly, 6-time All-Star, 9-time Gold Glove winner. Jim Leland never played in the major leagues. So save yourself those Google searches. We got you covered here on At the Letters. but yeah, if you win, honestly, at a certain point, the same thing applies to Ross Atkins. If they win, think about what would have to happen for them to win. It would be a lot of the players that he's acquired doing good things. And at that point, the narrative would shift. But if they don't win, well, there's no reason for the narrative to shift. So if they don't win, then these guys are going to continue to face the heat. And honestly, that's understandable. It's pro sports. You got to win.
Feels just rather early in the season to be having these conversations, doesn't it? That the Blue Jays have played 13 games. We got 149 to go. What are we going to talk about in July?
Oh, there'll be something. Yeah, something tells me something will come up.
Something always comes up. He's Ben Nicholson Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. Our producers this week are Nick Ontrod and Sho Ali. Thanks to them, as always. Thanks to all of you for listening. Talk to you next time on At the Letters.